Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, hello, and welcome. Or should I say welcome back to the Indie Football Podcast, live from Moscow, as we are... and have been pretty much every day throughout this World Cup. It's a big one because I believe today might be the day that it carries on its journey home. More on that later. First, I guess we should review the day's incredible World Cup action. And of course, I'm not alone to do that. Sat alongside me for the first time in weeks, months maybe. It feels like forever. It's about at least 20 games ago. Yeah. It's Mark Critchley.
Hi, Ed.
And how are you doing? How was Sochi? How was your time away from Moscow? How much did you miss me on a scale of 1 to 10?
2.5.
Good, that's nice.
Sochi, I'd give a nice round 8. Lives up to its reputation as Krasnodar's Blackpool. I really enjoy my days, just waking up quite late with this... You know, and it stays dark there as well. That's the main thing, actually. Unlike Moscow, which gets bright at about 3:30 in the morning, like full daylight. There, it was until about 7:00. So you could, you know, get up quite late, walk, stroll down the seafront, walk to the stadium, enjoy your nice salmon and a bit of a caprese salad at Sochi Stadium, and then you know, hang around with. Oh, my friends.
All day. That sounds like you had a delightful bloody time.
Yeah, you know, very different from here, where we just tend to stay cooped up in the flat, but not that, that's fine as well. Like I said, that's fine. So, yeah, lovely.
So, he had a much better time when he left, basically. But he's back now, there's nothing he can do about it. And one of the reasons you're back, I guess, is for England versus Colombia tomorrow, which, again, I will get to later on, because first... I think we should talk about the late game, because the late game was probably the most entertaining of the two, in which Belgium breezed past Japan, you know, as everyone expected. You know, they're just a better team. But they had 95 minutes of utter torture before that final breezing in that move. Japan go 2-0 up after half-time. Probably Japan the better team in the first half, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think certainly Japan played a lot better than we expected. I know from my own personal, I haven't actually, Japan weirdly were the one team that I haven't seen any game of so far before tonight, because something's always been on, or you know,
traveling
like,
or whatever,
or like Germany versus South Korea, which was certainly field of more import that day. But yeah, no, I was kind of you know, surprised, impressed with Japan tonight and how they started. Certainly appeared quite difficult to break down. Belgium were dominating possession, kind of pinning them back a little bit, but Japan always, the goalkeeper apart, who I thought looked a bit shaky at times, they look quite comfortable with that. And I think, you know, for all this talk last week that we were saying, oh well, you'd rather have Japan than Colombia, wouldn't you? I think, you know, these two teams who could have caused England problems if England had been playing in this game, and like we saw, Japan did cause Belgium problems, certainly in the first half, but then more so at the start of the second.
I've seen quite a lot of Japan, and I've been quite impressed. They were a lot better than I expected coming into the tournament. They have a midfield packed with kind of playmakers, like number 10 sort of players, or deep line playmakers. And what it means is that they're very good on the ball. They pass it around nicely. They fill the centre of the park. They've actually come up against quite a few teams that basically let them do that, which, like Senegal, were kind of all over the place. Mm-hmm. And you watch that today, and Belgium were trying to like stretch the field as Roberto Martinez does. But all that did was just kind of leave Axel Witsel and Kevin De Bruyne, two of them, against five Japanese midfielders. He passed it around them at will. Takashi knew he was the best player on the park that first 45 minutes. And he slips through... I've got the guy's name. I've got it. Genki Yamaguchi.
Haraguchi.
Genki Haraguchi, yeah, I knew it. Genki Haraguchi, Vertonghen, slight mistake, but not one we're going to kill him for, I guess. And Haraguchi does this beautiful kind of half like stutter to set Thibaut Courtois off balance and then sticks it beyond him.
Yeah, well, it's one of those where you're thinking, oh, what are you doing? Right up until like he manages to actually get the shot off, and it's just got enough angle. He's got the angle just about right just for it to reach around Courtois.
Reach around,
yeah. Excellent. So, yeah, I mean, that was surprising. But when Takeshi Inoue,
yeah,
with the second, I mean, from there, I mean, it's easier to say in hindsight, but when they go 2-0 up, I was looking at it and I thought, wow, like, are they going to do this? And then I saw the clock and it was like, I don't know, what minute was Inoue? It can't have been any later than about 55 or 54 or something like that.
They've scored too early, if anything.
Well, that's it. And this is, I remember, do you remember the United played Tottenham in like 2001 at White Hart Lane, and Tottenham went 3-0 up in the first half. I think
Man City, Tottenham.
No, it was Ferguson's United. I think it's the game where Ferguson says to them at half time, lads, it's Tottenham. I think that's where it comes from. And they come back to win anyway, United turn it completely around. And the Glenn Hoddle afterwards was said, if anything, we scored too early. And it's, you know, I think he got mocked and ridiculed for it at the time, but it is a thing, you know. It is a thing, and a game state is a thing. And if you're forced to play in a certain way or defend the lead for a long period of time, where perhaps, you know, whatever physically, mentally, you aren't prepared to do it, then you can falter. And I think you got that sense. Maybe I got that sense slightly at 2-0, but then definitely, I mean, towards the end. We'll talk about the end. Should we get onto it?
Because what it forced Belgium to do was, you know, Belgium, I had the feeling, was they weren't that good in the first half. It didn't really come together for them. And what they probably would have done, because they would have trusted their superior quality in the way that kind of Spain seemed to yesterday, and they would have gradually notched it up. You know, take it like, we'll go up to 7 attacking, then we'll go 8 out of 10 attacking, then we'll go 9 out of 10 attacking. And then, because they're 2-0 down in like a minute, really. It was like 2 minutes, wasn't it, between the goals or something. And 2 minutes in which Hazard actually hit the post as well. So he has to go for the... Christ, we're in all sorts of trouble here. Mm-hmm. So he throws on, obviously, Nasser Chadli and Marouane Fellaini. But it works. I mean, the first goal was Vertonghen. And I'm not convinced that he meant it, but Vertonghen pulls them back to 2-1. And then there's still like half an hour or so to go, I think just less, 20 minutes to go. And then you've got Fellaini in there, and Japan are going into their shell a little bit. Japan still had chances on the counter, but it didn't quite work out. And then Fellaini, when was the Fellaini equaliser, which was obviously a towering header?
It was about 15 to go.
So 15 to go. And then it sets up a great ending. And so Belgium have the momentum. And, you know, again, we can argue if momentum is a thing or not. But So Belgium going forward, Japan having chances. Japan hit the post at this stage as well. And then, I mean, so where do you want to take it? So Belgium give away a free kick in stoppage time, which is about 30 yards out. And Keisuke Honda, the substitute, comes, and he's renowned for his free kicks, comes on and he hits an unbelievably good free kick. It's just, the Courtois just gets it. And I think a lot of goalkeepers wouldn't have saved that. Mm. They get a corner. They send a lot of men up for the corner because they're knackered and they just want to kill this game. They feel they can do it. And then what happens?
Well, then is one of the best transitions in play that you're going to see at this World Cup. And I'm sure everybody who's listened to this has seen it by now. But I think a lot of people have picked out Romelu Lukaku's role in it, even though he doesn't touch the ball. It's absolutely spectacular the way it's his run down the right hand side of flank of Belgium's right across the face of the goal that pulls the defender away and frees up I'm going to say his name wrong, but Meunier.
Yeah,
okay, it's a type of wine, isn't it? Found out,
is it? Maybe
maybe it is. Anyway, so that frees that guy up to come down the right, and then the cross. He comes towards the byline, the cross comes in. Lukaku could take it, steps over the ball, knowing that Chadley's behind, is coming on the finish, and Chadley's finish takes a moment, but like, yeah, straight in. Like I said, you've all seen it now. My favourite bit personally is, I think it's when De Bruyne picks it up from Courtois in the first instance, and he's kind of like just running, charging into Japan's half, and there's a single Japanese defender, I think it's Yamaguchi, he's just stood there like, oh god, like totally mortified about what's going to happen, and he can see it, and he's just fixed, rooted to the spot. And then, like I said, everything that I've just described happens from there. I think I saw a few people, and I think there was a bit of a debate about whether Japan should have thrown so many forward on the corner, but it comes back to what I was saying just there before. I think you could almost tell there was a sense in this Japan team that they'd had the chance to win it, being 2-0 up, and they just looked a little bit out on the feet, and it was like, you know what, if this goes to extra time...
Yeah, yeah.
Make, you know, we don't really want to give Belgium another 30 minutes to score. So I have a bit of sympathy for them in that they thought, we've got a last corner here, there's 30 seconds left, because that's all there was, 30 seconds. And perhaps if we can get something off this, then, you know, we're through. So a bit of sympathy for them on that. And yeah, well, yeah.
And what they needed, basically, was there's one thing they're trying to avoid. And what they're trying to avoid is the perfect counter-attack. And what occurs is the perfect counter-attack. Mm. The ball falls to Kevin De Bruyne, who'd had a very, very quiet game, to be polite. Not in a great situation for him, playing that central midfield role, I don't think. But anyway, he picks the ball up about 30 yards out. And the thing that people, I think, underestimate about Kevin De Bruyne, he's really fast. He's really, really fast.
He's not slow, no. Yeah.
And he picks up the ball and he shifts through the gears very quickly to get to top speed. And suddenly, he's motoring up the centre of the field. Mm-hmm. And either side of him, there are red shirts streaking up the field. And you see the Japanese defenders, as you said. And then suddenly they realise there's about two or three of them there. And there's about four or five red shirts. And they're not catching him. And as you see Meunier flying up on the right... and Chadley flying up on the left. You've got Lukaku, who makes a run from kind of centre-right across the defenders to take him with him, which is perfect. And you realise the perfect pass is... I mean, we're watching it as it happens, and it's like if he plays it to the right here, they're in all sorts of trouble. And he has to make the pass obviously perfectly weighted and perfectly placed, but this is Kevin De Bruyne. So it goes perfectly in that channel. Meunier gallops onto it, fizzes it across first time. Lukaku's dummy is sensational because it's almost like a striker's instinct there is to, you just want to try and kind of awkwardly clip it home. Mm. And most strikers would try that there, especially like in the last minute of a game, you know, and you think of the adrenaline in that moment when you just run probably like 100 yards. But he steps over it, and Nasser Chadli, the obvious hero of any World Cup, is at the far post to score. Belgium go ballistic, and all the Japanese players are just flat on the floor. And their World Cup dream is over, but might it be good news for the World Cup as a whole?
I think it sets up a really enticing quarterfinal against Brazil. So if that's good news, then yes. And I think there's something to the argument that... over the last couple of days, that it's been fantastic, the knockout stage so far, with Spain going out and with Argentina, France the other day, and then of course like the culmination of the group stage last week with Germany. But I do have sympathy for the point of view that perhaps we were losing too many of the, you know, the contenders and the top quality sides a bit early, and you kind of, yeah. You want the last rounds of the competition to be stocked full of talent, because, you know, this is the business end now. I think I'm right in saying that we've got 10 games left now, just 10, and really it's single figures, it's 9, because no one cares about the third place playoff. So from here on out, you know, we want this tournament to live up to the reputation that it's earned for itself so far, and really impress us over the last few weeks. And I was fearing that perhaps if Belgium go out and it's a Brazil-Japan quarter-final and Japan don't quite get the breaks again, then it's a bit of a foregone conclusion, and we lose a bit of something in the latter stages. I think we all remember 2002 and how that kind of disappointed towards the end. So, and perhaps it's the best result for neutrals, but you couldn't help but feel sorry for Japan at the end when the players were out flat on their feet.
No, I the thing I liked about Japan is that we do think of them as kind of not a minnow, but certainly an underdog, a team that you don't expect really to go deep into the tournament. And so often those teams come and play, they play defensive, negative, conservative football, and Japan haven't done that at any stage. You know, which I appreciate. It means the game's entertaining, which a lot of the time when it's a World Cup and you're not invested in the game for whatever reason, it's good. I think it does set up a better quarter final. I had much greater hopes for Belgium before this game than after this game. This game was not good from them at all. But they do live to fight another day. They do live to kind of make up for it. But I just can't work out how this system doesn't get shredded to pieces by the Brazil team that we saw earlier in the day beating Mexico.
Yeah, and I think the concern tonight would be, it's a weird one because you don't want to be critical of Martinez, because when...
Well, he did well with the subs, for sure.
Well, this is it though, isn't it? Because he did well with the subs, but does anyone have anything insightful to say about why those substitutions worked? Because everybody saw that Fellaini and it was Fellaini and Chadli were coming on, and yeah, perhaps we have biases because, and I think Fellaini's I think he gets a lot of undue stick, and I think he can be a very effective player, but it's not something, you know, if that's Martinez's plan B, then it's so far removed from his plan A, then you wonder, like, if that happens again, are they going to get the same breaks? You know,
but plan A wasn't working.
That's true, but I mean, you look for some kind of like thread and some kind of, perhaps some kind of consistency with it, where if it feels like it's just kind of like throwing the big lad on, and like then that isn't foolproof, is it? And it isn't quite as coherent as the system that he has in place as plan A. So do we expect Fellaini to turn a game around again if they're 2-0 down to Brazil with 20 minutes to go? I think that's the big question that you would have tonight, and it's probably still no.
That's because Brazil are a lot taller than Japan, and to be honest, it was just it was deserved that they went behind, but as soon as they really started pressing on, I think Japan felt, I think, that they could defend a 2-goal lead, and that was probably their biggest mistake. They had two very physical aerial challenges in Lukaku and Fellaini at the end, and it just never looked like they were going to hold them out. Like, as soon as the Vertonghen goal was rubbish as well. That's the thing, is when you're trying to hold out and keep an upset going like that, you can't give them the easy goals. You can't give them the last one's incredible, and I know they overcommitted men forward, but so many things have to go right for that Chadli winner. So many things have to go right.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm always happy to leave that possibility open, because you need three perfect passes and probably the step over and the finish. So that's fine, but you know, even like Fellaini gets up really well. Obviously, he's good in the air, and the header is down, but it is central to the goal. The keeper is, as we said, like shaky. He's got like in cricket what they call crocodile hands, where you try and clap to catch the ball rather than kind of using.
Scoop.
Yeah, you're scooping. Your arms should be like working in parallel, rather than like the jaws of a crocodile. And yeah, so it's a shame to see Japan go out.
Do you know the last goal, sorry, the Belgium's goal, you know what it reminds me of, even though it's completely different? It reminded me a lot of Michael Owens against Argentina in St. Etienne. Just because suddenly a break is on, and like there's a couple of defenders that people were pointing this out the other day on the anniversary, that are really deep. And you saw, like we're saying, with Yamaguchi's just kind of stood there. But there was almost like an air of inevitability about it, like, oh bloody hell, right, here they go. And it was just so thrilling to witness, and all the better for coming in the last minute as well.
It was. I mean, they kicked off and the game was over. The goal that it was not like at all, which I'm going to say it was like, is Ryan Giggs's goal against Arsenal in the FA Cup semi-final.
Yeah.
Just the rampage.
This is a great counter-attacking team gun. We've picked up two individual solo efforts.
It's a new section tomorrow in goals that weren't like the goal that we're going to comparing it to. We might have James Rodriguez's stunning strike that put England out, and how it was in no way like Paddy McCarthy's goal for Crystal Palace against Derby County in 2010. We should probably talk about Brazil, and rather than you or I do that, let's throw it over to our man in Samara today, a very sleepy Miguel Delaney.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah, evening from a very hot and sticky Samara. Probably the warmest place I've been in Russia. Makes Moscow, which has been very balmy the last few days, very cool. And I actually think those conditions might have affected the game to a slight extent, because Mexico went into that match trying to do what they did against Germany and almost blow Brazil away with their pressing and their energy. But you can't keep that up. And even in better conditions, I don't think it would have too much of an effect on Brazil, because Brazil knew that was going to be the case. And they proved themselves tonight, maybe above anything, that they could well be the most intelligent team left in the competition. What really stood about Brazil for me today, there was first of all, I suppose most conspicuously, and despite what happened with his usual theatrics with that incident with Layun, although Layun still should have been sent off, he stamped on Neymar, there was the maturity of Neymar's game. And I think that reflected overall. Neymar has obviously become the grand figurehead of this Brazil team. He dominates everything, all discussion, to the point when he didn't even score the goal, he acknowledged the contribution of the goal scorer Firmino in the way that's usually reversed. But beyond all that, I think he's shown greater maturity. Like he personified Brazil in a better way today, because he had a much more stripped down game, much more efficient game, in which he did things for the right reasons rather than kind of for his own selfish reasons or for flair or whatever you want to call it. I think that was best illustrated with a necessary backheel for the opening goal. And Brazil's performance in general was stripped down and efficient. But what most stood out beyond that, Neymar's influence, was actually for me, how good that defence is. I'm just writing a piece on it now that should be out at the same time as this podcast on how they defend, because Chiche was very interesting after the match. And you really went into the mechanics of how they basically look to limit space. And I think that's probably what's most impressive about Brazil. There was a moment that late in the game when Fagner made some block, and he celebrated the block with his teammates in the way it was reminiscent of Chiellini and Buffon. I know that's obviously a standout piece of defending, but what's actually better about Brazil is when they don't have to go to those lengths, because what really strikes is how much they seem to limit the space for attackers and limit what they can do before the opposition even realise. And that's really, really intelligent. It actually reminds me a bit of Burnley, and that's no faint praise. No, that I think it's compliment to both, just the intelligence to defending. And Chicharito went into that after the game, how they do it, in which he says they concentrate on all these movements and the shape of it. But first of all, they mark the space, then they go for the ball, then they finally go for the player, but they usually don't even need to get to the player. And I suppose this comes after a few days after Pique had been talking about how the way you win World Cups, and he's someone who knows, of course, despite what happened on Sunday, is true defence and limiting chances. And it was something Spain didn't do. It's something that Brazil have perfected. And I think it's why they're now my overwhelming favourites. I think Belgium will struggle to open them in that way, despite their abundance of attacking talent. And I say that as well, having, to be honest, I really hammered Brazil after the first match in what I thought was an infantile performance, quite a poor performance against Switzerland. But in the space of four games, and maybe that was just kind of one of those one-off games that happens at the start of a tournament, it's difficult to get into it. But in the space of four games, they've really grown and they look really assertive and commanding. and I'd have a lot of confidence in them going all the way. I think teams are going to really struggle to break them down.
I think they will, Miguel, and I think that Brazil are still the huge favourites for this World Cup because there was some weird thing earlier where people started comparing them to Burnley, which is bizarre to me because if Burnley had Neymar and Coutinho, they'd probably be like the perfect team. Because all you're saying by saying that they're like Burnley is they're compact and they're good at defending. They don't concede goals. Brazil, how many goals have they conceded this top competition? That the Lichtsteiner one.
Yeah.
How did that come about, a Lichtsteiner goal?
It's a header, isn't it?
Just a header.
I think.
I can't even remember it. So
we were at Germany-Mexico that day.
We were at Germany-Mexico. It was weeks ago now. But they haven't looked like conceding the games I've watched recently, and more to the point, they're improving with every game and they look better with every game. And Willian, who looked shaky in one of their group games, is now one of the more important players, and Coutinho and Neymar and Gabriel Jesus, that little link up is excellent. So I think they have to be considered favourites. They will certainly be favourites against Belgium given the contrasting displays today. But that is on the other side of the draw, what we call the rubbish side of the draw that no one cares about. What we really care about, Critch, is the patriotic side of the draw. The side of the draw that eats Coleman's mustard and Walker's crisps and gammon. And what do you think is going to happen tomorrow at the Spartak Stadium at 9 p.m. local time when the three Lions of England take on the coffee makers of Colombia?
What do I think is going to happen? I'm really finding it difficult to make a good solid prediction about this game because last week I mercifully missed all the podcasts that involved any discussion about whether it was the good or the bad side of the draw, which means I can now come back on the podcast a week later and say that I 100% always thought that this was the right side of the draw to be on. Now, that doesn't mean that you throw a game or like try to lose or anything. But
it means when you're 1-0 down, you don't put Harry Kane on.
Well, yeah, and it means that you don't go all out to win, which I think is the kind of, you know, it's a kind of dichotomy. We're either trying to lose or we're not trying to win hard enough. Well, no, you can rest your players, and you know what happens. So I think it was the right decision last week, but this. You know, the fallback is that you've got to play a difficult Colombia team who I think perhaps, I don't know, it's hard to get a gauge on them. I don't know, you might have seen a bit more than me, but I think they're good, but they've definitely got weaknesses, and like England certainly can beat them. So therefore all the fear and all the nervousness about, oh, but it's Colombia, you know, we're going to lose to Colombia. I didn't think that was necessary. I don't know, you've probably seen more than I have, so your thoughts?
I think that if they were at full strength with James playing fully fit, I think this is a real 50-50. I think it's a coin flip game. They came out of what was an evenly matched, some could say weak group. I think it's decent. It was, you know, certainly an interesting group, wasn't it?
In the end, competitive, definitely.
Japan, Senegal, Colombia, and I'm missing someone.
Poland.
Poland were crap, actually, weren't they? Forget that. Poland were awful. But everyone else was quite good, and they basically were the better team in their first game, despite playing 85 minutes of it with 10 men. Against Japan, and I think they very nearly won it with 10 men, and they ended up losing to a late goal. But if Carlos Sanchez hadn't had that brain meltdown 5 minutes into his World Cup, and I do think a lot of that really was to do with like the fact that his heart was still racing from the national anthem and all that sort of stuff, then I think they win the group handily, to the point that they could probably rest players for that final game. Instead, they played their first team in Volgograd in like the hottest game of the tournament so far. I think it was 37 degrees in the end, on the kind of day that England rested all their first team players. So I think that's a huge advantage for England. I think no James is obviously a big advantage for England. Now, they said that the scan said there's no tear, but that doesn't mean he's fit. Colombians that we've talked to don't think he will start against England. He has had the same problem in his calf. He lost a month of the season at Bayern due to that. He was deemed unfit to start the opening game and then came on with half an hour to go. They lost that game, so they were desperate and had to win the second game. So he started, but couldn't really run, but still played a couple of killer passes, including that goal for Juan Cuadrado's excellent second goal that day. And then he was deemed fit to start the third game and came off after half an hour. So all of that tells you that he's obviously not been fully fit at any point during this tournament. So having gone off in the last game injured, you see no way that he's actually going to be properly fit for this game. And thus, I think England have to just discard the possibility of him playing. If he comes on or whatever, fine. But he's not going to be James Rodriguez at any point. So you've got to deal with the team you're playing against. And the team you're playing against, if you look at it on paper, I think isn't that good. well, no, I mean, like, they've done well so far. And I do like Colombia. I like Jose Peckerman as their coach because he's old and experienced and makes the right decision more often than not. Most famously didn't when he was in charge of Argentina in 2006. Took off Riquelme, which is something that they've never forgiven him for. But the back line is kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's gettable. Like, Yerry Mina has had a lot of praise because he scored two-headed goals. Yeah, but actually, his first season at Barcelona was so ropey that they want to put him out on loan next season. And he's not, well, let's say he's got a clanger in him. Davinson Sanchez is excellent, I think, but you know, he's alongside someone who potentially isn't. Mejica at left back, Arias at right back. The central midfield, Wilmer Barrios, who Tottenham have been keeping a close eye on, the Boca Juniors midfielder, sort of that all action sort of type, but again, not the, you know, he's not as good as any of the England midfielders. Carlos Sanchez was at Aston Villa, you might remember. Not as good as any of the England midfielders. Cuadrado is a very good player, despite having a weird spell at Chelsea that definitely didn't work out. He's got enough success in his career behind him for us to say that he's a good player, and I think you see when he plays for Colombia, he's very good as well. Quintero has been one of the breakout stars of this tournament, has all the talent in the world. It's just whether he can implement that, and the last couple of games he has. Luis Muriel is really fast, but not actually very good at kicking the ball and stuff. Which I've always thought was a key part of football. He's carved out a half-decent career for himself, but the downgrade from James for fitness is huge. And then up front, Falcao, who has certainly recovered from the nightmare he had in England. He is a good striker again. He's obviously never got back up to the level of being the best centre-forward in the world, which he certainly was for a while at Atletico Madrid. But really, you know, considering, where do you think England's weak spots are?
Where do I think weak spots are?
England's
weak spots. I think we've known for most of the tournament so far that you're looking at the defence. I think it's strange because coming into the tournament, they'd had so many kind of clean sheets and nil-nils and impressive performances against the likes of Brazil and Germany, where they've managed to shut them out. But it's still, you wonder, like, even in the Panama game, I thought in that opening kind of 20 minutes when they weren't giving up chances, but there's opportunities to run at this defence. I like it. I like the way it's set up, and I think he's right to go with Maguire and Walker rather than, say, Jones and Cahill, who would be more traditional centre-halves. I think it works well because they often have to step up and play balls into midfield and even act as kind of like little pivots sometimes. But I do wonder about the gaps that they can leave and the space between them and the wing backs. And then I think also he's had a lot of attention this week as well, but, and we knew coming into the tournament again, but the goalkeeper, Pickford, whether any of the other two options below him are better, I don't think you'd change it now anyway. So that's the weak spots. But I mean, you're going through the Colombia team there and we're saying, you know, this guy isn't as good as this guy in England's midfield. But I remember the BBC pundits doing that before the knockout game in 2010 against Germany, you know, because who's this Mesut Ozil anyway? Like, he's not Frank Lampard. So you're always conscious about this stuff.
The difference is that I've actually watched these players play before. And most of the BBC pundits, well, I mean, like, There are very good BBC pundits.
My
but
point is,
the usual suspects don't.
My point is that yes, we can match them up on paper, even if we know the players well. But it's about how they actually operate as a unit together. And I think, like everybody said, it's not an original point, but do we know how good this England team is yet? We don't really. I remember being on this podcast after the Tunisia game, and I was one of the more like optimistic or upbeat people about that performance. And I still think the first 20 minutes there were the best that we've seen from England so far, even though they, you know, Panama, I don't think you can read too much into that anyway. And again, a lot of it was kind of like penalties or pot shots or whatever, or set pieces. That first 20 minutes against Tunisia, where there was a lot of good interplay in and around the box and chances created, I think that's what you'd want to see more of tomorrow. It's just hard to get a gauge on England still. If they win this game, I imagine the hype train's going to go into overdrive, isn't it? And all that terrible "it's coming home" meme's going to be everywhere. But like I said, this, I think they were right to go for this side of the draw. It's just that, you know, and to be honest as well, I make this other point, people might disagree with this, but even if they do lose tomorrow, it was still right to go for this side of the draw, because it's a numbers game, isn't it? And I think we all understood that, you know, this Colombia and the rest of the teams, that Sweden, Switzerland, whoever, they're all weaker than the other one. So whether or not they win or lose, I think it was right to do it. They've just got to make good on it now, because otherwise I'm sure there's plenty of people won't share my opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's you got to take the process over the result. If you get the process right, over time it's going to come and break for you. I think you can't avoid the fact that England have got a good chance of going further than they've gone for a long time in the World Cup.
Yeah.
By accident, almost. You know, slightly by design. Slightly by design, but much more by accident. And that's, you know, that's not about, like, some great things have happened by accident. Penicillin was invented by accident, you know. There are lots of things that happen by accident which are fine. And
my mum always said I was a great accident.
Yeah, no. I agree with her. You were a terrific accident. But, you know, I look at the Colombia team and I think it is to their benefit that Peckerman reins them in slightly, their natural tendencies. And they do have players there that can hurt you. But in a situation, like, I'm trying to work out, like, who's the biggest obvious overmatch that they would have on England is, assuming Eric Dier doesn't play, then Quintero will try and dangle off the back of Jordan Henderson between him and the back three. And Cuadrado will try and get behind Ashley Young. That they're the two where you're looking at it and it's like, okay, so that looks to me about it. Like, Falcao has notionally three centre-backs marking him.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, like, he hasn't got, but, I mean, he's lost it, you know, that he had awful knee injury. He hasn't got explosion off the ground anymore. He's still a good technical striker and he knows what he's doing around the penalty box, but he's not going to turn and leave three centre-backs for dead.
If he's got three centre-backs on him, then if there's three centre-backs on one player, one Colombian player, then I think it's England's problem, not Colombia's. We've seen Falcao a few years ago for Monaco in the Champions League come up against John Stones. Interestingly, I think JPB's done a piece about this, hasn't he? Or at least mentioned it. Where he absolutely, you know, he bossed Stones that night and had him all over the place. So,
is there an argument for playing Cahill?
I don't think so. Just because I think that, as I said before, I think for that back three to work how Southgate wants it to work, it needs the personnel, those three defenders in there. It needs Maguire, it needs Walker, and it needs Stones, because from the point of view of England having the ball, those three are far better at distributing it than Jones or Cahill would be, like I said before. So I would focus on that still, because like you say, this really is a 50-50 game. I thought that when all the permutations were going around.
I don't think it's a 50-50 game without James. I think England are favourites and should be favourites.
I think they should win, but I think look, in this side of the draw, we're all talking about this side of the draw. In the last 16, is there any team that you would have, like, a Colombia the least favourable team in the whole draw? Like, if you, they're probably the one that you would want the least. People keep talking up Croatia, but I don't think we've seen. I really don't.
Do you mean the quarterfinals? Do you mean in the quarterfinals?
I mean, sorry. So I mean, it's a bit of a weird way of putting it. I mean that in this side of the draw, yeah, in this side of the last 16 draw, everyone's saying, "Oh, we want to be in that one because, like, you know, it's got the." I think so. Basically, what I'm saying is that in this side of the draw now, England and Colombia are probably the two best teams in it. And if any, you know, everybody's saying one of these teams goes to the final, I think probably the winner of tomorrow's game is the one that goes to the final. That's what I'm saying.
I would have rather played Colombia than Spain, but I imagine you're not including them.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Russia.
Yeah.
Mm. Russia, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about Russia because, you know, it's just...
Just momentum.
The way things happen. Johnny's written an incredible piece about Russia, which is, if it's not live, I think it might go live first thing tomorrow. But really good stuff. And you're going to want to read that. Yeah, Croatia. I mean, Croatia in the last 16 would be brutal because they have got a lot of quality, but they didn't look amazing against Denmark. And they, I kind of feel like they should have gone out against Denmark.
I don't see how it ties together with Croatia because it's, we've got this fantastic midfield, but the link between that and the attack, which is basically Mandzukic running around like all over the place and
ever willing but never scoring.
Well, yeah. But turning up at the back post and like trying to hit, which is probably what he should be doing more often, but the rest of the time he's just roaming around. Like, from Croatia so far, you're always wary of Modric because he's such a good player, but I'm not particularly impressed, and I wouldn't even feel that. If England were playing Croatia tomorrow, then I would be confidently backing England to win, put it that way. With Colombia, I'm not so sure because of that first game against Japan as well, where that's really, like you say, coloured their tournament and it coloured their group stage and meant that they had to play in a certain way and get certain results. And for that reason, it's kind of two unknown quantities going at it.
I think virtually the opposite. I think I'd be much more scared by Croatia.
Right.
I'm much more scared by Croatia, not least because Colombia basically, you know, have one outstanding player and he's missing. Croatia have a few outstanding players. I don't think the system is quite right. Do you see the French newspaper Le Monde called... Luka Modric, the le grand passeur, le petit perjure, the other day, which is the great passer, the little perjurer, relating to his court case back in Croatia, yeah. Which I thought was like a needless place to go with in a headline. But I mean, it is interesting the behind the scenes stuff with that Croatian team.
To be fair, you can imagine a team that is about to, you know, half of them are about to go to jail, going all the way to the World Cup final. That's the kind of narrative that this World Cup needs and deserves, actually. So
the funny thing is, if England did draw Croatia, the amount of stories that would suddenly pop up about how Modric should already be in jail.
Yeah. Well, that's the semi-final there, I suppose. That is the semi-final that is going to happen, not just a potential one. Yeah.
So you're seeing the Brazil-Croatia final?
No. What, from here? Do you really want me to predict my final from here?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm going to say that because I think England will win tomorrow and I did say before that whichever of these two teams gets in the final, that Brazil will win the World Cup against England in the final.
So what you're saying is that it might be coming home because anything can happen in a 90-minute final.
No.
Saying there's a chance.
It's not coming home.
You're saying it's not coming home.
They're coming home. Trophyless with nothing,
and tomorrow
maybe in the final.
Tomorrow we'll find out. And tomorrow night, I guess we'll have a special live podcast from Spartak Stadium after the game.
Yeah,
with Johnny and Jack involved.
And me and you.
Was
a given. I see.
Yeah, right. We're already included. They're bolt-ons, really. And we is there another game tomorrow? Yeah, Sweden Switzerland. Who's going to win that one?
I think it's going to be Sweden, you know, because
that'll do. Sweden to beat Switzerland.
Okay.
Oh, you like Sweden, do you? Have you been to a Sweden game?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Tell us about Sweden.
Sweden are very untypical of any, well, maybe not any, but a lot of teams at this World Cup. They're basically a little bit like Panama, but very good. Not quite as rough, but they are direct, uncomplicated, but effective. I've said several times now, they were my dark horses in our predictions on the tournament, and I think I've been proved right on that one already, so happy with that. But Yeah, no, like they're the kind of team that, again, if England do go into the quarterfinal and they're against them, people will think, "Ah, well, here it is now. This is our gimme quarterfinal that we wanted." But I wouldn't be so sure, because having watching them that time against Germany, it's not that they created too much, but when they did, it was good and really really found some openings. So I think they'll probably put away a Switzerland side that, other than their game, and even then at their game against Serbia, I've not been too impressed by so far. So yeah, I think it's Sweden.
Sweden have already seen off Italy, the Netherlands, and Germany.
Yep.
And next will be the real home of football, the home of FIFA, Switzerland. So yeah, Sweden would be England's opponents in the next round. Yeah, so as I say, podcast tomorrow night, which will be live from Spartak Stadium. All four of us, Miguel sadly can't make it, he is flying back from Samara, but the four of us will break down England's World Cup win over Colombia, the 3-1 victory.
2-1
victory. So until then, of course, make sure that you tell your friends, rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast, and we will be back.
You'd have to cut this with that little break, actually.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.